The University of Detroit Mercy presents Ask the Professor. The University Tower Chimes ring in another session of Ask the Professor, the radio program on which you match wits with University of Detroit Mercy professors and their guests in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your temporary substitute, totally impermanent host, Edmund DeWint, sitting in for your regular hostess. What name do we use? We now call actresses actors, so I guess it's host. Just host, moderator.
Neutral.
Yeah. Kathy Bush. Anyway.
Fearless leader.
Our fearless leader.
She who must be obeyed.
She who must be obeyed, definitely. So we have some of the regular panel with us, in fact, quite a substantial number of the regular panel with us, and a special guest. On my left, from the Department of Philosophy, Professor Beth Oljar.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. On her left, from the Department of Religious Studies, the chair of that department, Professor Jim Tubbs.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. On his left, across from him, our special guest, still hanging in here from last week.
He brought a change of clothes.
Yeah, we just put him in the closet, and there he is, Robert Del Valle.
Merry Christmas, Anna.
And on Robert's, that would be his left, from the Department of History, the chair of that department, Professor Roy Finkenbein.
Greetings, Edwin.
Greetings, Roy. And on his left, my right, from the Department of Mathematics, Professor Jeffrey Boltz.
Merry we meet again.
Yes, we do. We certainly do. Okay, on our last program, we were just starting a series of questions from Mr. Mark Nymark, I think, by the better pronunciation, although it's probably we're mangling it as I speak, but who's a Detroiter who lives in Paris. Lucky him. And he's
asking healthcare alone.
And he's showing up how much we don't know about Paris.
Yes. So he's asking his questions about Detroit and Michigan. So. What is the alternate name for the Place des États Unis? I can't do French.
Place des États Unis.
Avenue de Coca-Cola.
No, that's good. That's good. But that's not what it's called.
Oh, because they own half of Europe. I mean, that's, you ever been to Eastern Europe? Every umbrella says Coca-Cola on it.
That's true. That's true.
It's not University Place.
No, it's named after an American president.
Is that the
early
Kennedy?
American president. No, an early American president.
Washington?
No, that's too early.
Jefferson?
Yes, it's Square Jefferson.
Square Jefferson.
Okay.
He's a big fan of the French.
Bonus. Okay. What was the original name of the Place in Paris? The name was changed when the U.S. ambassador established his residence there, and the name was considered inappropriate for the ears of English speakers. What was it originally called? Well, it's only because the ambassador obviously didn't know much French.
The Place de Merde or something? Or?
Well, that's close. It's Place de Beach.
Okay.
Which is pronounced as beach. A town in eastern France, yes. Okay. What work is Bartholdi most famous for?
Statue of Liberty.
That's right. Bartholdi was the sculptor of the Statue of Liberty, but who was the engineer who made the construction of this giant sculpture
possible?
Gustave Eiffel.
Yes, that's right. Mr. Eiffel himself. There are at least three American presidents honored by having their name on an avenue in Paris. Name two of them.
Well, we know one is not W.
That's true.
Jefferson and Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, which Roosevelt?
Franklin,
that's right.
Kennedy?
I think Kennedy has
it. Yes, Avenue de President Kennedy.
Ixpinine Parisien.
Yes.
Actually, his good line in Paris was, "I'm the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris."
That's right.
Which was pretty
The others are Avenue of President Wilson. There's also a Rue Washington, a Rue Lincoln, a Square Thomas Jefferson, and perhaps others. Yeah. Who was the first European to visit Michigan?
Étienne Brûlé?
Yes. And who was he?
He was a voyageur.
That's right.
Fur trapper.
That's right. Very good. What is the origin of the name of the city of Detroit?
It means straight.
Straits. Yeah. That's right.
A little stream.
Detroit. Yeah, that's right.
Or Detrout, as the kid.
Detrout, yeah.
The big fish.
Or Detroit, you know.
Detroit.
Which two qualities do LaSalle, Cadillac, and Marquette have in common?
Qualities?
Yes. What two qualities do LaSalle, Cadillac, and Marquette have in common?
As people? I mean... Rather than as, like, locations?
Yeah, as people, one...
Well, they've
one,
been cars,
one of the,
right?
They're yeah. both. That's right. They're right. That's right. They are the names of cars.
Okay.
Not that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Marquette?
Marquette, an upscale Buick.
Oh.
Produced only in 1930.
Gee, our old Marquette ran great.
And then someone decided to bore holes into the sides of these things, and that became the standard Buick, I guess. Okay. What is the name of the first parish established in Detroit?
St. Anne.
St. Anne.
St. Anne. That's right. That's right. July 24th, 1701. Cadillac and his people landed at Detroit 2 days later, on July 28th, St. Anne's feast day, construction of the first structure began. St. Anne's Church. The site was just west of what is now Jefferson and Griswold. The 8th and present church is now at 1000 St. Anne Street, formerly 19th Street, at Howard, near the Ambassador Bridge.
And it is a very, very beautiful church.
It is. It is.
I'm guessing this guy has his Detroit 300 Almanac handy while he's...
he probably does, you know. He's got a little nostalgia for the hometown. You know.
I'm paying for the fact that I didn't grow up here.
Oh, yes.
St. Anne is the patron saint of the city of Detroit.
I think so. I think so.
Being sorely tested as we speak.
I know. How true.
No lie.
What country was Detroit a part of in 1792?
Canada?
What county? Excuse me. What county?
No. Canada. Oh, okay. Upper Canada.
That's right. Upper Canada. What county?
Oh, I was right.
Yeah.
Essex, then? No.
Kent.
Exactly. That's it. Kent County, Upper Canada. Maps using the Treaty of Paris, by which the UK recognized American independence, were not very clear about where much of Michigan was actually located. And for many years, Detroit continued to be part of British North America. The first elections held in Detroit for the Parliament of Upper Canada in Newark, now Niagara-on-the-Lake. Isn't that?
Hmm.
How about that?
Charming.
All right. What do a lake in Louisiana and a fort in Michigan have in common?
A name?
A name.
Pontchartrain.
Pontchartrain. Okay. That's right. That's right. Also the name of a wonderful French restaurant that went out of business a few years ago, Café Pontchartrain.
Wasn't that the minister? Detroit was originally had some... The Fort Pontchartrain, isn't it? The Minister of Marine.
I don't know who Pontchartrain was exactly.
There's a marvelous historical plaque in Hart Plaza.
Yeah,
half it's in French, half it's in English.
Yeah. That's where we need Kathy here. Mm-hmm. Kathy's going to come back to answer these kind of questions. She knows this kind of stuff cold, you know. How did Detroiters used to amuse themselves on the island of the White Wood in the Detroit River?
Went skinny dipping.
It was Bablo. It was Bablo
right.
Island.
That's right. That's right. Bablo. Bois Blanc. That's right. That's right. White Wood. Yeah.
Something other than burning the city was a form of...
Yes, it was. But they only do that when they win ball games.
That's right.
You know, they win a ball game and they set fire to the city. And that's a little bit of local culture.
What would happen if the Lions won the Super Bowl? Would there be anything?
It'd be a nuclear explosion.
I understand now. What Millen has been doing all those years is saving Detroit.
Right. Protecting it from itself.
Keeping it standing and unburnt.
That's right.
You'll thank me later.
Yes. Oh, I'd say we're going to get mail on this, but I don't think we will.
On his behalf.
That's right. All right. An island in Paris, downstream from the Eiffel Tower, is home to a monument to Franco-American friendship. What monument is it? I'll tell you. It's on the crossing of Avenue Rapp as it comes across the bridge from the left bank.
Is it a modest, small-scale version of the Statue of Liberty?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's been heavily foreshadowed now by the fact that it's very close to
where
what I
Princess
call
Diana
Dead
died.
Diana plots.
And there are bouquets of flowers all around it.
That's probably what you'll get a letter on.
I'll get a letter on that, yes. And all kinds of graffiti
gold-plated
written on there. Diana died for our sins is my favorite.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yes. Great.
Yes, yes.
Jesus wasn't enough?
No, as my wife said one day, you know, it's amazing to see what's the survival and coming back to life of
ninth century saint cults. Mm-hmm. Now we know how they got started.
Well, the Michael Jackson movie had been doing pretty well.
That's right. That's right. It's going to have the same kind of consequence. Many people do not recognize this flame as being that of the Statue of Liberty and believe it honors another person. Who do people believe it honors? And this is the same person we're talking about in the previous question.
They believe it honors Diana because that's what's there, part of the statue. But it's gold plated, isn't it?
It's gold plated. It's very bright. Yeah, it's very bright. It stands out like a sore thumb.
Well, they had to put something under the highway tunnel.
Well, they did. Yes.
Under there.
Okay. The night of her death, bonus question. The night of her death, Diana Spencer was heading to the house in the Bois de Boulogne, leased from the city of Paris by the father of her boyfriend, mm-hmm. Dodi Al-Fayed. Mm-hmm. Another famous pair of Britons lived in the house after World War II. Who were they?
This was Edward and Duchess of Kent.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Okay. Edward and Wallace. Yes, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
The woman he loved.
The woman he loved.
Gave up his crown.
I love that wonderful story that somebody told once, and I like to believe it's true, that he was sitting next to her at dinner at some state banquet when he first met her, and he reached for something, and she slapped his hand and said, "Don't reach." And the person telling the story said that he looked at her with only be described as love.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he'd found the woman he'd been looking for.
Maybe the first person that ever said don't.
Based on her looks.
And it wasn't based on her looks. It was based on her...
You'll find the right word.
But not on a family radio show, I won't, that's for sure. All right,
Times would have kept them apart.
Yes.
In terms of their appearances, they would have made a good match.
Martin Luther King and Josephine Baker have recently been honored by the city of Paris. Which of the following recent works was not named after King or Baker? Number one, the footbridge over the Seine between the Orsay Museum and the Tuileries Gardens. Two, the floating swimming pool in the Seine near the new National Library. And three, a park created on former rail yards in the northwest of the city.
Please let it be the swimming pool.
It is a swimming pool for Josephine Baker.
Oh, that was not the one that was not named.
The rail yard, I'm going to guess that was for Martin Luther King.
It is.
Just because he's from Atlanta, and that was a huge railway hub back then.
That would make sense.
So it was the first
QED
answer, right?
Yeah. It was fake. That's right. That's the name, named after Leopold Sédar Senghor, former president of Senegal. So, I never knew that little bridge had a name, in fact.
I didn't either.
Yeah, it's just... just a footbridge, duh. Anyway, yes, the new National Library. That is quite an amazing achievement by the French. They built this huge library to replace the Bibliothèque Nationale, and it's multi stories high, and it's all glass on the outside. And they discovered after they had opened it that they now have to
bleached all the books.
Destroying the books, so they had to put big shutters on the windows.
Oh, I bet that looked attractive. Or looks attractive.
Yes. And the actual reading room is, I think, three stories underground.
Right.
You descend to the depths to work in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Only the French could have built a building so stupid, but... The last question, number 20. The American Center in Paris moved to a new building in the Bercy district in 1994 before closing forever a year later. Who is the architect of the building? And his hint is, he's a Canadian now based in Los Angeles whose works closest to Michigan will be found in Millennium Park in Chicago and in the University of Toledo. Who is this man?
So this is a famous architect?
Apparently. I've never heard of him, but then I don't... no architects, so I'm no
help. No clue.
Frank Gehry, G-E-H-R-Y.
Okay. Heard of him, but
subject of a very fine documentary film, and I saw it.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was.
Oh my gosh.
Doggone.
It says, after the bankruptcy of the American Center, the French state bought the building and has converted it to the house, the Cinématique Française Film Center. So that's a good use for it.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. How did you do here? One. You blew two of them. That's all. That's not bad.
Oh,
You did not stump Mr. Nymark, but I'm certain he doesn't care. Sorry. And we should send him a autograph photograph anyway.
So.
I think he deserves
that.
And as we ponder this, let's take a little break.
It's an Ask the Professor flashback.
The University of Detroit presents Ask the Professor. The University Tower Chimes ring in another session of Ask the Professor, the radio program on which you match wits with University of Detroit professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. I'm your host, Edwin DeWint, and today we have our regular panel with us. On my right, from the Department of Religious Studies, Professor George Pickering.
A pleasure to be here, as always.
Pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, I mean, it truly is.
On his right, from the Department of English, Professor Claire Crabtree.
Hi, Edwin.
Hi,
glad
Claire.
To be here.
Glad to have you here.
It's an honor and a privilege. I'm going to go on now. I'm going to make a speech.
All right. Are you through? Claire's right. From the Department of Theater, Professor Arthur Beer.
Hello, Edwin.
Hello. On our last program, we were near the end of a set of questions from Bertie Bates of Grinnell, Iowa, one of our longtime listeners. She was asking you questions about movie stars.
Darling Stevens, I love it.
Yes, Darling
Obscure,
Charlie.
We'd like to add obscure movie stars.
This woman was a nightclub hostess in later years, but when young, made a short subject doing some lightning-fast trick riding.
Annie Oakley.
No.
A nightclub hostess.
Catherine the Great.
That's right. That's right. Her first name was the name of a great southern state, big state.
Texas.
Texas Guinan?
That's right.
Texas what?
Texas Guinan used to run a speakeasy in New York, and she was famous for saying, "Welcome, suckers," when people came in.
That was Sophie Tucker.
No.
How many times did she say that to you, Arthur?
I wasn't there back then.
But his father told him.
Right.
We're back, and now we have some questions that we hadn't finished from a previous program from Thomas Haywood on William Shakespeare. Yes. Yes, all right. What was the name of William Shakespeare's first daughter?
Susanna.
That's right. Susanna. That's right.
How many children did he and Anne have?
Three, I think. The boy Hamnet and then the two daughters.
Judith was the other daughter, I believe.
Yeah.
One. No daughter named Glee.
No. William and his wife became the parents of twins in 1585, a boy and a girl. What were they named? I just gave the names Hamnet and you got
My
Judith.
My apologies. So.
That's all right.
Jumping
all right.
The gun as usual.
I wasn't paying attention. Okay. Hamnet died at the age of 11. In 1596, about the time Dad was writing King John.
How
sad. He said, is it that William wrote Hamlet shortly after his son's death? Not really. No, he wrote Hamlet around 1602 or 3, so that's not shortly after Hamlet's death.
It's a few years.
Yeah. It may explain why he made Arthur of Brittany and King John about 8 years old instead of the 17 that he was. You're gonna murder a kid in a play, make him very young, so you cry. Make him an obnoxious teenager for crying out loud. You sit there and say, "Hooray!
That would be too tempting.
Finally got rid of him." God, whining little. Never mind. Nobody knows for certain when William left Stratford-upon-Avon to go to London. It is also not known what he was doing prior to working in the theater. Which of these is the most commonly believed theory on Shakespeare's lost years?
He was running a three-card Monty game.
No, that's not what he was doing.
He was writing Hamlet 2, but couldn't publish it because he was so embarrassed.
Yes.
It's not multiple choice? Are we supposed to
It's supposed to be, but I don't see anything here. Here we go. Here are three options.
Okay. Three options.
They're not arranged in... sequence. That's the problem. I'm not used to seeing prose. So he was a schoolmaster. He went traveling to Italy, and he became a priest. Those are the three suggestions. The fourth suggestion lately is that he was part of a secret Catholic society in the north of England, being trained as a commando.
I'm betting the first.
I would guess go to Italy.
It's the schoolmaster. That's what they generally think. Hmm. I mean, the point is they don't have any clue as to what he was doing.
Oh, man, imagine having a writing assignment and you got to turn it into Professor Shakespeare.
Yeah,
that would be kind of a bummer, wouldn't it? Yeah.
No,
this isn't even in meter.
Well, especially if the assignment was a sonnet.
Yeah.
You clearly don't understand iambic pentameter.
Yeah. This is not a bit like meter, fool. How did you get into this school?
Very good.
Okay, whatever.
Very good. William was valuable in the theater as he could both write plays and act. Which fellow dramatist called William an upstart crow in 1592?
Marlowe.
No, it wasn't Marlowe. It was a guy whose name is a color. He wrote such great works as King Edward I.
Are these things that are in your current manuscript?
My current project, yes. On
Green?
English history plays.
Was
Green.
It
Green?
Yes.
Green, yes. Robert Green, yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah, he said he calls him an upstart crow who thinks he can bombast out a line of blank verse better than the rest of us.
He's pretty good on the blank verse.
He certainly was. William was a founding member of which theatrical group in 1594?
The King's Company?
Not the King's Company, no. It's
Chamberlain's Men.
The Lord Chamberlain's Men. Okay. The Lord Chamberlain's Men. Both a main playwright and a major actor in this group. Prior to this, it is thought that he would have been associated with a number of acting groups such as the Queen's Men, Pembroke's Men, and Lord Strange's Men. Yeah, no one seems to really know one way
Lord or Strange's Men sounds like a comic book title, you know?
It really does, doesn't it? Yeah, superheroes.
Lord, Strange,
Lord Strange's Men, yeah. So the Lord Strange Men, that's another one. That's that would be the more religious version of that. Okay. William's new theatrical group was founded in the same year as the theaters were reopened, having been closed the previous year. Why had they been closed?
Plague.
The plague, yes. Here it comes again. On a return visit, it's the Black Death.
It's coming soon to a town near you.
Near you, yes, yes.
Haven't figured out that burying dead bodies next to the public water supply is probably not such a good idea.
And befriending all the rats.
That's exactly.
Right. That's right. Oh, what a cute little fuzzy creature. Yes. Come on in.
Eat our leftovers.
Oh, dear. London's Globe Theatre, completed in 1599, was a playhouse of William's theatrical group. Yeah, once from 1599 it was. Was it situated on the north or south bank of the Thames River?
South.
That's right.
As is the replacement now.
Yes, exactly. And Mr. Haywood explains that that was because the area south of the Thames was notorious for its brothels, illegal animal fighting dens, betting houses, and other such places. And the real reason that it's outside the jurisdiction of the City of London.
Mm-hmm.
See, once you crossed the river, you were no longer in the City of London.
The Bishop of Winchester's jail was nearby, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah.
Well, they could haul a few people in.
Oh, yeah.
But who wants to go to the theater and pass by the brothel? I mean,
you gotta
and
make
go
it,
bat. You know, you get a threefer. You get
yeah, that's right. You see, you gotta make it a real occasion.
Wasn't there an American actor based in England named Sam Wanamaker who was obsessed with
he got the Globe Theater built.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
He's a good actor.
Fine actor. He was blacklisted in the '50s. And he's
lovely daughter too. Became Zoe Wanamaker.
Yes,
yeah.
An incredible actress in her own right. Yeah, in fact, when they opened the Globe, he had just died. And but the dream had come true, and they did a production of Henry V, and she was the chorus in Henry V.
Oh, for
a Muse of Fire. Yeah, that was. And of course, they turned it over to Mark Rylance, and that was a mistake. I have a problem with the Globe Theatre in London. You know, they tend to take every Shakespeare play and play it for laughs. They think it's a comedy. You haven't lived until you've seen Titus Andronicus played as a comedy.
Oh, my.
Where does the Royal Shakespeare Company perform? Do they have their own theater?
They used to use the theater called the Barbican, which is in the city near the financial district. And the Barbican Arts Center, the concert halls and everything else, and theater, movie theaters, they built a stage specifically for the RSC, one in the main building and then underneath it a smaller theater that was the equivalent of the Pit in Stratford. And that worked beautifully. They used to be based at the Albury Theater, which the Aldwych Theater, which is really a kind of a third-rate theater. But they had this thing for years, and it was magnificent. And then Adrian Noble took over the leadership of the Royal Shakespeare Company. He hated London. Just hated London. And he made a big show of the fact that they were moving out of the Barbican. They were not going to come to London at all. They were going to just play in Stratford and go to the north and tour. And for a while they did that until they realized they were cutting their throats financially. Mm-hmm. And now what they do is they come in for a limited season, usually in December to about March, and they rent theaters that are available. It's goofy. You know, they need a permanent home in London again. Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense.
Why shouldn't they have, I mean, wouldn't it make sense if they had the Globe?
Well, now the trouble is, you see, the RSC is not interested in doing this kind of outdoorsy, say authentic recreation of playing styles of the 16th and 17th century.
And how do you make Romeo and Juliet a comedy? I was thinking about earlier remark.
Well, your star Jim Carrey is
yeah,
Romeo.
That would want me to do it. No, I mean, I once saw a Tempest there with Vanessa Redgrave as Prospero. That was bad. And they managed to turn Caliban into a slapstick comic figure, which is hard to do with Caliban. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a very tragic figure, and he's not a laugh-a-minute kind of guy. But that's what they did with him, and they'd done it with everything. I mean, my worst was Edward II, in which Gaveston came out in the first scene in a tutu. And I thought, oh, how subtle.
I mean, I guess if you did Othello, you could make Iago like the Riddler, like the Joker.
Well, they'd done things like this. Yeah, you know, I mean...
What a waste of a great character.
Marvelous thing.
How about Richard III?
Oh, they never done Richard III. You'd think they would, you know... There's a lot of humor in that.
Yes.
Have you ever seen a movie called Eve's Bayou? It was a remake of Tempest?
Yes.
How was that?
It's not bad. You know, it's like the other remake of The Tempest, of course, is Forbidden Planet. With Robbie the Robot and all of that, you know, Walter Pidgeon.
Thought of it that way. Huh.
Yeah, well, no one had.
Peter Greenaway. What did Peter Greenaway do in Prospero's books? I actually have that movie on it.
He basically just has John Gielgud standing there, and everything's taking place in his head, basically. You know, that's what he does. And an awful lot of nude bodies riding all over the place.
Yeah.
One of his earliest films was a remake of Taming of the Shrew called 10 Things I Hate About You.
Oh, yes.
Which was great.
I know. They've done a lot of those things. And they're fascinating attempts to wrestle with Shakespeare without, you know, trying to do a Romeo and Juliet with...
Or setting Macbeth in contemporary African politics. People running around with machine guns.
I mean, that's been standard since Orson Welles was doing that stuff at the Mercury Theater years ago. You know, the voodoo Macbeth.
And Julius Caesar,
all fascists, you know.
Correct me if I'm wrong, is there a new movie out called Me and Orson, or Orson and Me?
Yes. It just opened up in New York, I think. Yeah, he's an incredible actor in his own right. More than just doing Doctor Who.
Ken and Em need to make some more Shakespeare.
Yes, he does. Ken really does. He's done a Richard III on the stage, but not in London. He did it in the north of England. And he's done a Macbeth, but not in London.
They should have done Taming of the... Well, it actually doesn't matter whether they're married to each other or not, as they, in fact, are not anymore.
That's true.
I thought they should have done... I love Much Ado About Nothing, but I wish they'd done Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw him direct and play in a King Lear, and then he directed and played in A Midsummer Night's Dream that I wish somebody had filmed because it was stupendous. He played Peter Quince, the head of this third-rate acting company. It was wonderful. Oh, it's time to end the show. That was the bell, and we got carried away. I'd like to thank the panel, Professor Oljar, Professor Tubbs, hello, Professor Finkenbein, Professor Boats, and our special guest, Robert Del Valle. And Ask the Professor is transcribed at the facilities of the Communication Studies Center at the University of Detroit Mercy Campus. It's produced by Michael Jason. Our technical director is also Michael Jason. The executive producer is Vivian Dix. And until next time, this is your temporary, purely transit host, substituting for Kathy Bush, Edwin DeWitt.